Good morning. I want to welcome you all to the courtroom for the second and last oral argument this morning. We especially want to welcome, is it Krivitz High School students? They please stand. Thank you for all coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin in this court. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite students from around the state to come to the court for an oral argument. And if they come, we send them material about the case. They may have engaged in some activities relating to the case. Come to oral argument, listen to oral argument, and at the end of the second argument in the morning, these students meet with a justice of this court who has been assigned to meet with the students that day. The discussion is on the procedures of the court in taking a case, deciding a case, and issuing an opinion. The discussion is not on the substantive issues that are in the case. Everyone is invited to attend that session, including counsel. The session today with the justice, the session will be with me. I'm the assigned justice. So we've been introduced to you. I'll introduce the court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice of this court. To my right is the, are we done? Ann Walsh Bradley.
Yes.
To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Looking to my left, we have Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. And seated next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. I should have asked, but I'll ask now, if anyone would like a summary of this case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will provide a summary. Anyone need a summary? All right. We shall now proceed with 10AP505CR. State versus Randy L. Martin. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Martin is Brian C. Lichtstein of the Frank J. Remington Center of the University of Wisconsin Law School. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. I urge this court to keep it simple. This should have been a quite unremarkable Miranda case, resolved by settled basic rules, presenting no need to further complicate an already complex area of the law. The only thing that has made this case remarkable is attempts by the lower courts and the state tying themselves in knots to avoid the result that is mandated by the basic analysis in Miranda. I urge you to keep it simple for law enforcement, for judges in the lower courts, and for the lawyers and suspects involved in these cases. So what does that mean here? Well, it means a simple analysis. First, Mr. Martin was indisputably in custody. That was found by the Court of Appeals and by the trial court, conceded by the state in the Court of Appeals. And the facts strongly support those concessions and those findings. Second, he was subject to interrogation. Police found a gun in his vehicle, walked over to him while he's in custody, and asked, "Whose gun is it?" Conversation ensued. They then followed up and directly asked, "Is the gun yours?" later asked him to describe the gun. This is direct questioning about the crime at issue. You have custody and you have direct questioning. Under the cases, it's very clear that Miranda is required in such circumstances. You don't need to know much more to resolve this case. The rest of my presentation will essentially be about all the things this case is not. These are things that were raised by the lower courts and by the state to sort of get around that basic analysis that I already outlined. First, we had the trial court making a finding that police, quote, asked no questions after they approached Mr. Martin with the gun. Well, that's contradicted, flatly contradicted by the evidence in the record. We know from the police officer's testimony, he asked, is the gun yours? That's a question. He then followed up and asked Mr. Martin to describe the gun.
Counselor, was that the first mention of the gun when the officer said, is the gun yours?
It was not, Your Honor. The first mention. The first mention was right after the police officer found it. He came over with it and said to Mr. Martin and to Mr. Henry that he wanted to know whose gun it was.
That was the first mention of the gun. He Yep. came to them and asked them, whose gun is it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So this entire interaction was begun by police questioning about who the gun belonged to. This notion that's in some of the lower court findings and in the state's brief that Mr. Martin prompted the conversation about the gun is contradicted by the record. The initial conversation about the gun was started by police, and I recognize that there are cases in this area about when suspects prompt interactions with police and that then Miranda is not required, but that's just not what happened here.
I thought the first question about the gun was Martin asking, why are you arresting my uncle? Am I mistaken? Maybe I just misinterpreted it from the briefs.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think you are mistaken about that.
Okay.
I think the record from the suppression hearing, I think, is clear that what occurred is the officer found the gun in the vehicle, walked over to the two men and said, here's a gun. I want to know who the gun belongs to.
Did they respond to that question? Neither one of them acknowledged it was their gun, if that was the first question, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why can't you separate this? You have a series of communications between the police and the defendant, right? So you start with a question, whose gun is it? And then you follow on two other questions, is the gun yours, and describe the gun. But in between these questions, the defendant talks, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
And why isn't the trial court, in effect, right? Says, okay, I'm ignoring the first question, whose gun is it? And we have the defendant communicating with the police, and there's a rule that volunteered statements are okay without Miranda warnings. There were no Miranda warnings in this case, right?
That's right.
All right. And he is in custody. So without Miranda warnings, if a defendant volunteers information, that's no violation of Miranda, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but we're not talking about two separate interactions. We're talking about one quite short rapid-fire exchange that was initiated by police questioning. I just don't think this is the kind of situation where you can say there's really two conversations. There's a single interaction, and that interaction is begun by police questioning. The cases in this area that that deal with a suspect prompting police questioning are just totally unlike this. There are situations where the entire interaction was begun by the suspect saying something to police, and then police responding to clarify what the suspect said. Totally unlike this situation. Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Could I ask some factual questions here? The defendant was arrested. The person in the passenger seat is taken out of the car, and then there is a search of the vehicle. And there's a reference to a gun being found in a compartment. What does that mean? Was there actually a container, or is it just under the seat?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that it's a container underneath the front passenger seat. I haven't personally seen it, but my understanding is it's some kind of a container that was removable and taken out of the vehicle.
Okay. Now, you've talked about questions being asked. What the officer has found the container with a gun in it. What do you think the officer should have done at that point?
Well, I think, Your Honor, to begin with, the gun and the people who were arrested are entirely secured. The situation's entirely under control. There's no urgent need to resolve the situation. So I think what Miranda says in that situation is, if you want, you the police, want to further investigate whose gun it is, there need to be Miranda warnings. I think the answer in the case law is clear.
We're at the scene. Would you have questioned at the scene, or would you have taken people, both of them, back to the jail?
That's up to the police officer. I think it could be done either way. The legal requirement is that if further investigative questioning is necessary, Miranda is required, whether it's at the scene or in the station house. The case law is clear that Miranda is not limited to station house questioning. That's clear from Innes itself, where the questioning occurred in the back of a squad car. It's clear from this court's Cunningham case, where the questioning occurred in the bedroom at the suspect's house. So Miranda's not limited to the station house. I think the police could have done the questioning in either place. Certainly it's more convenient to do it on the spot, but Miranda's required is my main point, and that's clear from the case law.
Counsel, you've indicated a couple minutes ago that this was a rapid-fire exchange, quite short. Does the record reflect that? Does the record have any information as to how quickly after the whose gun is it you have the exchanges back and forth between the defendant and the police officer?
Your Honor, I don't believe that either officer said specifically how much time elapsed, but I think reading the testimony of the officer who was involved, it's pretty clear that there was not any long period where something else was going on. He basically walked over, confronted the two with the gun, said, I want to know whose gun it is, and then the exchange that we're talking about ensued. So, you know, I think it's quite a clear inference that it was a quite short conversation, and certainly not separated by anything that would render it into two interactions. Even if it was rendered into two interactions, I don't think that would matter because the entire interaction was begun by police questioning, but I think it's one. The cases that deal with this, as I said, the interaction was initiated by the suspect, and so that just is not our case. So that's one, I guess what I would call a red herring. It's one of the things that this case is not. The other thing this case is not is what the Court of Appeals decided the case based on, which is this false confession exception. Now, the state in its brief has said that, in fact, that's not what the Court of Appeals holding was based on, and I suppose I'm glad to hear that. I think if that's what the state believes, I think this court's opinion should reflect that there is no such thing as a false confession exception to Miranda, and there's a couple reasons for that. The first reason is it's entirely unsupported by any precedent. That kind of an exception lowers the federal constitutional floor. The Court of Appeals didn't have authority to do that. They made up an exception out of whole cloth that basically lowers federal constitutional protection. But probably the bigger problem with it is it just doesn't make any sense. Any police interrogation has dual purposes. It has a purpose to get a true confession if the person's guilty. It has a purpose to avoid a false confession if the person's innocent. Anytime the police interrogate someone, they're trying to avoid a false confession. So it's impossible to know under that standard whether Miranda's required. A police officer who's doing his or her job is thinking, I don't want to get a false confession. Part of my purpose here is to avoid that. So is Miranda required? Is it not required? I wouldn't know under the standard outlined by the Court of Appeals. So to the extent that I'm right in my brief that that is the basis of the Court of Appeals holding, I think that should be soundly rejected, and I'm glad to see that the state isn't defending that position anymore. I think this court should accept that implicit concession. And perhaps I'm misreading the Court of Appeals opinion. Either way, I think the important thing is that's not the law. Another thing that this case is not, it does not fall under this doctrine of on-the-street roadside encounters. We've seen some discussion in the state's brief about the Berkemer case. And Berkemer is a case that is about a roadside traffic stop, sort of the typical standard roadside traffic stop. And what's important about Berkemer is that it makes very clear that if a typical traffic stop graduates to custody, Miranda's required. So the reason Berkemer does not apply here is stated in the Berkemer opinion itself. The state's reliance on that case is entirely misplaced. Berkemer makes clear that in the situation where this kind of traffic stop graduates to a custodial arrest, Miranda's required. Berkemer supports Martin's position, not the state's. The same goes for the... I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you, Your Honor? Sorry. The same goes for the notion that this was general on-scene questioning. That's an exception that's stated in Miranda itself. But that, too, is explicitly for questioning of people who are not in custody. And you can see that from the very cases that the state relies on, the Wisconsin cases on that, Kramer, Esser, Britton. All the people in those cases not in custody. So that, too, cannot apply here. We have clear findings by the trial court, statements by the police officer, holding by the Court of Appeals, there's custody. Those cases can't apply here. The state also suggests that this is a situation where perhaps there was a new crime, that, well, there was the disorderly conduct, and then following that, there was the possession of a gun, and that maybe he was in custody for one, but not for the other. Well, we have the Armstrong case here in Wisconsin, and what that case says, it applies directly to this situation. Custody originally for the disorderly conduct, but once the questioning was about the gun, once he's a suspect for questioning about the gun, Miranda is required as to that questioning. That's exactly the situation in the Armstrong case. Suspect in custody for one thing, but as soon as he becomes a suspect in the other thing, Miranda is required. So Armstrong takes care of that argument entirely. And then we also have a point, finally, that the cops here were merely confronting Mr. Martin with evidence. So we see some reliance by the state on the Innis line of cases. That's Innis, Cunningham, Fisher, Hambly, a series of cases where the U.S. Supreme Court was dealing with the scenario of police not directly questioning someone, but merely confronting them with evidence or discussing the crime in front of the suspect. That's the factual scenario in Innis. That line of cases, again, obviously inapplicable here because this was direct questioning about the crime. This wasn't confronting the suspect with evidence. It wasn't discussing the case in front of the suspect. It was direct questioning. That entire line of cases is of no help to the state.
What kind of interchange between the officer and the person who was arrested and the other person would have been permissible in this line of confronting with evidence?
Well, I mean, I think it's entirely permissible. Cases are clear for the police to simply discuss the case with each other in front of the suspect. That's not impermissible. Cases say as long as the police aren't directly questioning the person, that's fine. It's permissible for the police to answer a suspect's questions. Suspect is asking the police questions. Police are allowed to answer those. The line is crossed when police go from those things to direct questioning about the crime. And that's what we have here. I think it's an easy line for this court to draw, that there are some things that are allowed, but clearly the one thing that needs to be preceded by Miranda is direct questioning about the crime. Is the gun yours? Describe the gun.
If you were the person arrested, could the officer have said, I have just found a compartment with a gun in it in your car?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a much closer situation, because that sounds to me a lot like what happened in Innes. Comes quite close, confronting with evidence, directly saying to the person, here's what I found. I think in that situation, that would be permissible, but that isn't what happened here. What happened here is they took the next step and asked the question. And when the question is asked, that's the critical point. So to me, that's a close case, and certainly you might get arguments that Miranda's required there, but to me, that's permissible. What's not permissible is to take the next step and ask the questions. Because when the question is asked, that's when the sort of force of the interaction is on the suspect. An officer just saying, here's what I found, and showing it to the person the way you did, doesn't have the same force of a question as the direct question itself.
Well, the suspect had the presence of mind to deny any knowledge of the gun.
Well, initially, both men denied knowledge of the gun. That's true. Now, when it became clear to Mr. Martin that his uncle was being arrested, being charged with the gun, the police said to him, be a stand-up guy. Be a stand-up guy. You can save your uncle from being arrested for this. When that became clear, then Mr. Martin sort of changed his tune. And whether that's because the gun actually was his or because he wanted to save his uncle from getting arrested and taken to the police station, he knew that his uncle had family obligations and it did not want him to be arrested. He then decided to take responsibility for it in order to save his uncle. And that goes, again, to one of the points I'm making, which is that although this wasn't a station house interrogation, there was pressure applied to Mr. Martin to confess. The pressure comes not only from the fact that he's handcuffed entirely under police control, which asserts some level of pressure to comply, but it also comes from the interaction involving his uncle. Look, be a stand-up guy, save your uncle.
You don't think Mr. Martin initiated this conversation?
I don't, Your Honor.
The way I understood the facts was they had the initial encounter, then they found the loaded .22 caliber gun, then they went over and advised they'd found a gun and said they wanted to know whose it was, and they both denied it. They didn't know anything about it. And then the officer took action, not words. The officer placed Mr. Henry under arrest. And the officer was asked, what are you arresting my uncle for? Something like that. And the officer replied that he was placing him under arrest for carrying concealed weapon. And then Mr. Martin then initiated the conversation by saying, why are you arresting my uncle? Why are you taking him to jail? And I advised him, well, I'm arresting him for carrying concealed weapon. And he stated, well, if I tell you the gun is mine, will you let my uncle go? And at that point, I just said, well, I don't want you to say it's yours if it's not. I just want the truth. Is the gun yours? And he said, yeah, it's mine if you let my uncle go. So what part of that isn't Mr. Martin initiating the conversation by saying, hey, why are you arresting him? If I tell you it's my gun, will you let him go? I mean, is the officer supposed to say, no? It looks almost like the officer was trying to arrest the right person.
Well, Your Honor, I think maybe we have a difference. We're just reading the question of when it begins differently. I think this goes to my answer earlier, which is that the interaction involving the gun begins when the police officer finds the gun, walks over to the two men, and says, "I found the gun. Whose is it?" That's the beginning of the interaction. Miranda says you can consider the totality of the circumstances. So that's the start of it, and that's not started by Mr. Martin. Mr. Martin's standing handcuffed on the side of the road at that point.
So you're saying everything should be suppressed, even though Mr. Martin continued the conversation?
Well, all I'm saying is that the interaction begins at the point he's confronted with the gun and asked, you know, whose gun is it? I don't think it makes sense to say that happened, then the interaction stopped, then a new exchange begins that he initiated, because this is one continuous conversation. It's not as if it's two separate exchanges. So I guess to answer your question about what I'm saying should be suppressed, I think there's really only two things that are of any import, which is his statement that it's mine if you let my uncle go, and his description of the gun. I think both of those things need to be suppressed. And I would note that the trial court actually found that initial question, when he brought the gun over, when the police officer initially brought the gun over and asked the two men, "Here's a gun, you know, whose is it?" The trial court found that Miranda would have been required there. It's just that the answer to that wasn't incriminating.
Were they both under arrest at that point?
I think there would be a debate about whether Mr. Henry was under arrest at that point. He was certainly being detained. It wasn't quite as clear that he was under arrest at that point.
Well, it was pretty clear that he was being put under arrest when Mr. Martin initiated the conversation and said, "Why are you putting him under arrest?" Right?
I think that's fair.
But that was after. If that's the point of him being arrested, that was after the officer came over with the gun, right?
I think that's probably fair. I don't think the point at which his uncle was under arrest is quite as clear, because we don't have police testimony about that. We have very clear police testimony about when Mr. Martin was under arrest.
Well, he does say, you know, it was after he brought the gun over. He went over to Mr. Henry, asked. He advised he had found a gun, wanted to know whose gun it was, and they both said it's not theirs. And at that point, he says, "I advised Mr. Henry I was placing him under arrest." So initially, Mr. Henry was not under arrest, right?
I think he wasn't told that he was under arrest until that point. Whether he was restrained or something, I don't know. But I'm not sure I would quibble with you at all about the point at which Mr. Henry was under arrest.
I just want to know the facts. I just want to know what's right.
It sounds like your reading of the record is fair.
Well, it sounds to me that your position is started with a question, short communications, that is, brief time for communications. During the communications, there were questions by Mr. Martin. And therefore, you just apply Miranda. He was in custody. There was an interrogation. Look at that start. It covers the whole series of communications. That's not how the Court of Appeals treated this. Court of Appeals, as I read the Court of Appeals, says this is an Innis case. Innis was not a direct questioning case, right? Innis was a case in which commentary was made by the police, and the question was, although the commentary did not have a question mark in each of the sentences, the goal of the commentary was to prod an answer from, if that's the goal, then it's a violation of Miranda. So the Court of Appeals treated this really as maybe two or three communications. One, the first one, is it a gun? And then thereafter, no interrogation. And what the police did, does that amount to an Innis violation?
Your Honor, my light's on. Could I give you a brief
yes.
response mm-hmm. to that? I think this is a simple case. And I think it's not an Innis case. And the reason it's not an Innis case is that, as you know, Innes is not a case where there was direct questioning. There was questioning here. So my response to that is it's simply not an Innes case. I'm not sure I would read the Court of Appeals opinion as splitting the interaction quite as much. You're probably right about that, but I read their basic proposition as the reason this questioning doesn't require Miranda is that it was designed to avoid a false confession. When you get down to their reasoning, the basis for their holding, that's what I read the heart of it as being. Now, maybe I misread that.
I agree that that is one of the issues that the Court of Appeals stated and constitutes part of its holding, and that raises questions. And the fact that the defendant responds to a question and does not incriminate himself does not mean that there hasn't been a violation of Miranda. Or stated another way, if there was interrogation within custody without Miranda and the defendant didn't say anything that incriminated himself, it's still a Miranda violation.
It's just that there's no evidence that needs to be suppressed.
Yeah, although ultimately it might be changing a story, which may raise questions, but it's still a Miranda violation. It just doesn't come in. Now, is the search warrant issue, is the search of the automobile dead?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. Counsel wants to keep this simple, but my understanding is his rule would be any time during an encounter between a suspect and an officer, if the officer asks a question, regardless of the suspect's answer, that anything that happens after, even statements that are volunteered by the suspect, are automatically excluded. Moreover, we don't consider the entire context of the encounter. We don't consider the totality of the circumstances. We just start at the point where an officer confronted him with evidence or asked a question. We don't consider what caused the encounter in the first place. And I think it's important to point that out. Clearly, with respect to the arrest for the road rage, which brought about this encounter in the first place, Miranda was not implicated. He was taken into custody for that offense. Miranda warnings were not given, and they did not need to be because the officer never initiated any questioning and never engaged in the functional equivalent. Nonetheless, with respect to that offense, Mr. Martin volunteered statements and asked questions. His immediate question was, why am I being arrested? And the officer truthfully answered, because you pulled a weapon on that man. And then Mr. Martin volunteered the inculpatory statement, well, that's because he cut me off. That sets the stage for what happened after that. That results in his arrest for disorderly conduct, which in turn results in the search of the car incident to the arrest, which in turn results in the discovery of the compartment, the plastic bin containing the gun, which in turn results in the officer confronting both men with the gun. Now,
just for clarification, I think in the first three sentences I had a question, but I tried to follow the 1.5 minute rule and let you go for 1.5 minutes before I asked a question of you. I want to clarify, by reading the defendant's brief and just in the last part of the defendant's oral argument, he indicated that what he wanted suppressed were two statements. One statement was essentially, yeah, it's mine if you let my uncle go, and the other statement is his description of, it's a black .22 caliber gun. Those are the two statements. And in your initial comments, I understood you to say that you wanted it all suppressed. What's your understanding? Am I correct? Is it these two statements, or is it the total exchange that we've heard about here today?
My understanding is that they're not challenging the initial offer. Well, the initial question by Mr. Martin, why are you arresting my uncle? And I don't think they're challenging the initial state. Well, I could be wrong. I think they are challenging the whole encounter.
Because
especially in light of the comments today, that it appears that what counsel is arguing is that once the officer displayed the gun to the two men and said, whose gun is this, that immediately tainted everything that happened thereafter.
Okay, I don't understand that to be their argument from their brief or here today, but when rebuttal comes, we can ask if I'm right or you're right. The second thing I want to clarify is when we use the word officer, that there was here, in terms of the facts, a question. First of all, you have Sergeant Fiddler, who's the one that made the arrest. He's the one that was asked by the defendant, you know, what are you arresting me for? And his response, and I'm paraphrasing it because I don't have it directly in front of me, was something to do, I saw you have a gun. That was the stuff at the intersection. Then two officers came in another squad car, I understand the facts to be. It appears from the facts that Fiddler told the two officers, one of them being Smith, to search the car. Smith searched the car, and then it is Smith testified that he said, let me get the direct quote from his testimony, quote, I went over to Mr. Henry and where the defendant was, and I advised him I had found a gun in the vehicle and wanted to know whose gun it was. He testified, I think, quote, I think my wording was, whose gun is it? Now, we're talking about two different officers here, isn't that right? I want to clarify that. You've got Sergeant Fiedler, who made the initial arrest, then another squad pulls up. He tells them, one of them, or both of them, anyway, it was Smith who did the search and found the gun. Right? I want to clarify we're talking about two officers.
Were, yeah,
first one was before the squad arrived, and then the squad arrived, and then there was the search. Okay, got it. That's it.
And so Smith produces the gun, and in this court's decision in Cunningham would allow Smith to walk past both men and say, look what I found in the car. Then, and moreover, Terry v. Ohio would allow them to ask Mr. Henry, who was not yet under arrest but was suspected of possessing this gun because he was seated right over it, to then ask him, is this your gun, in Mr. Martin's presence.
Do those cases allow Smith to ask the defendant, who was in handcuffs and had been arrested, do they allow Smith, Officer Smith, to ask the defendant in his exact words, I think my wording was, whose gun is it?
Yeah, and I guess my argument is that if that is a technical violation, if you're going to conclude that that is custodial interrogation, that that is a very minor step from what is already permissible in this situation, that they can display the gun, make a comment in his presence about its discovery, and can ask Mr. Henry about whether he own the gun.
Okay, but that wasn't my question. Can they ask Martin? Can Smith, under Miranda, without giving warnings, ask Martin, who was handcuffed and had been arrested, whose gun is it? Can he ask Martin that consistent with Miranda?
I would say that he probably cannot ask that particular question. You know, again, it's tricky because when you look at what Miranda contemplates, you know, this is where I get into the discussion in the brief of the roadside encounter and the fact that we have a separate offense. And those factors, which, if nothing else, call into question whether that is necessarily impermissible. But I will concede that he should not have asked that question. But I will not concede that he should not have asked that same question of Mr. Henry in Mr. Martin's presence. And I will not concede that he couldn't put the gun in front of Mr. Martin and say, look what I found under your front seat, and then leave it at that. And then, as the trial court correctly found, when it did conclude, as Mr. Lichtstein correctly pointed out, the trial judge did conclude that they shouldn't have asked Mr. Martin that particular question. But the judge said both men immediately denied any connection with the gun. I don't know. And by the way, that was consistent with the trial testimony, where both continued to deny any connection with the gun. Everybody denied. The woman who was part owner also denied. But they denied, and then it stopped at that point. There were no more police questions. At that point, because of the ambiguous situation that was presented, because they weren't clear who owned the gun, and because Martin was already in custody for the disorderly conduct, police reasonably decide, based on probable cause, to also arrest Mr. Henry for carrying a concealed weapon. This now gets into the next phase of this encounter, where, as they are about to handcuff Mr. Martin, or Mr. Henry, rather, Mr. Martin asks, hey, why are you arresting my uncle? I hearken back to when he was arrested for brandishing the weapon at the other driver. Hey, why are you arresting me? This is a volunteered question. This is not a question initiated by police. It's a question initiated by Mr. Martin. Why are you arresting my uncle? Police have every right to answer that question truthfully, and they did. They said, for carrying a concealed weapon that we found under his seat. At that point, Mr. Martin volunteers to confess to this, to carrying that weapon, if it means Mr. Henry can then be let free. Miranda does not prohibit a suspect from talking to the police while in police custody, whether that's at the station house, whether that's on the side of the road. If a guy wants to talk with the cops, they're free to listen. And if a guy is going to ask questions of a cop, they're free to give honest answers. That's what happened here. This questioning was initiated by Martin. This statement was volunteered by Martin. And his offer to confess was, in essence, like Innes, the functional equivalent of a question of the cop. Hey, how about this? If I confess, will you let my uncle go?
Does the record reflect how much time elapsed between Smith asking, in his words, I think my wording was, whose gun is it? And both of them denied it. They said, I don't know anything about it. Smith testified that he advised Henry that he was going to take him, that he was taking him under arrest for carrying a concealed weapon. At that point, the defendant, Mr. Martin, blurted out, why are you arresting my uncle? So these are all quotes that I'm reading from Smith's testimony. Does the record reflect how much time elapsed between when Smith asked them, whose gun is it, and both of them denied it, until Smith advised that he was taking Henry under arrest for carrying a concealed weapon? Is there time lapse, the way that
I can't give you a specific time. I'll have to concede it was short. I mean, the entire encounter, from what I can tell, was 15 to 20 minutes from beginning to end. So I have to assume it was, you know, within a matter of minutes at most.
I read that same number in the record. I can't remember who testified to it, but I remember that number, and I got the impression that was from the initial arrest of Martin until the very end of it. So, I mean, that included the arrest for disorderly conduct. That's how I read it. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I mean, this was a quick encounter. I mean, there's no quick, between the time that the officer came upon Mr. Martin brandishing what he thought was a weapon at the other driver and the time that both men are hauled off, I think it was, I mean, I think the clear testimony was ironically from Mr. Henry, who I think was the one who testified it was about 15 to 20 minutes. And I don't think anyone questioned that. I don't think that was disputed. at any point. But, you know, again, this is a situation where you have, you know, we have the arguably the only thing that was done wrong here was to ask that question, whose gun is it? Otherwise, this was proper conduct from beginning to end. They could recover the gun. They could show the gun to the two men. They could ask Henry whether the gun was his. They could then take Mr. Henry into custody for CCW. They could then answer Martin's blurted out question, why are you arresting him, just as they answered his blurted out question earlier, why are you arresting me? They could then respond to his offer to confess, to let his uncle go. And they could reasonably, in light of that, you know, counsel is correct. This is not, at this point, the Court of Appeals isn't creating a false confession exception to the Miranda rule.
Should there be a false confession exception to the Miranda rule?
No. Miranda is not implicated where police are responding to a suspect's own questions. That's what we have here.
That's your position. Does any language in the Court of Appeals bother you? Any language in the Court
well,
of Appeals?
Well, I think I try to point out is that when they refer to all they were trying to do is clear up a false confession, what they're really doing is they're looking at the circumstances of this case, and they're saying in this situation, Martin's offering to confess, and they want to clarify, first of all, why he's doing it, whether he's being sincere about it.
Okay, and so you would not object to language in a Supreme Court opinion saying there is no false confession rule, that is, that you can question so that without a Miranda while in custody in order to make sure there's no false confession.
No, I think the wording should be when a suspect volunteers information and asks questions, the police are entitled to respond appropriately.
So this is the sentence. In the context of the particular circumstance of this case, we do not think that the individual statement Smith made can be divorced from the entire conversation, and then which refers to entire conversation, which was aimed not at interrogation, but instead at preventing a false confession.
Yeah, that language can be read broadly, but it need not be. I think, again, I don't know if the court has yet received the recent authority,
Moreno case
out of the Northern District of Georgia, but that when a suspect volunteers information, police are permitted to ask clarifying questions. Or when a suspect asks a question, police are permitted to answer it. That is not the functional equivalent of interrogation as contemplated by Miranda and Innes.
Doesn't that case, though, rely on or turn on who started the inquiry? If the police started the inquiry, unlike in the Moreno case, it would have been different. In Moreno, if I recall, the police did not start the inquiry. And, of course, it's the position of the defense here when the police asked the question, whose gun is it, that started the inquiry regarding the gun.
I don't think the significant point is who started the inquiry is so much as whether he was in custody. And that Moreno makes clear that it matters not. Even if he's in custody, police can do this. Now, I know of no case that says if the police ever ask a question, that's it. Anything that happens thereafter is no good, especially in a case where the police ask a question and the guy denies and then the questioning stops.
Well,
and then they continue with taking people into custody, and then that Martin's question, why are you taking my uncle into custody, had nothing to do with the cop's question, whose gun is it? It had everything to do with Mr. Martin, his uncle, being hauled off.
O'Brien, the defendant starts the communications with the state, with the law enforcement says, is it your gun, or whose gun is it? You start the communications with the defendant saying, talking about why taking Mr. Henry, into custody. The defendant views this as one communication. You look at the entire communication, and he says, this, Miranda wasn't given, the guy's in custody, you're asking questions, the end. That's his view. Your view is, well, you have several views. One, you say, oh, that's not really a question, whose gun is it? You recast that, although I think you backed away from it, you recast that as an innocent example, that he really is showing the gun and really is saying, oh, look what I found, a loaded gun. And then under Innis, he's entitled to say, you can show the evidence to the defendant. Well, that's not what happened here. Innis says, no question, but you can recast a non-question into a question under certain circumstances. You're saying there is a question, and you recast it into a non-question. I think you backed off from that and said, well, that was a question. So I agree with you. You have to back off the recasting.
Well, and I guess if I could follow up on that, the bottom line is that if it was improper for him to ask that question of Martin, whose gun is this, it's in essence harmless error in light of what would have been permitted in light of Venus and this court's decision in Cunningham.
Henry is not before this court. And Henry, did Henry say anything? Mr. Henry say anything?
He also denied any knowledge of the gun.
He's not before us. We've got Mr. Martin, and we've got a question. There's no comment. There's no doubt there was a question. Whose gun is it has a question mark? Now, if you want to recast that into an innocent situation, all right, and the court may buy that. As I hear your argument and as I read your brief, what you are really saying to the court is, okay, there was a question, there was an exculpatory answer, not incriminating, it's not our gun. And then you're saying, or I hear you saying, okay, after that communication stops, we are now starting afresh. And the afresh is where Mr. Martin says, if we don't arrest Henry, my uncle, I'm going to tell you about the gun, right? I mean, aren't you starting fresh there?
Well, if you look at the overall circumstances here, mm-hmm. if this is really compelled self-incrimination, why didn't he incriminate himself when asked? There was
Miranda says, as I understand it, if there's a violation, it doesn't matter whether the answer is incriminating or exculpatory. It's a violation anyway to ask a question without Miranda.
Right, and if he had said, yes, the gun is mine, then you'd have to suppress that statement in answer to that question.
Okay.
But his answer was, no, it's not mine, and the questioning ceased.
Right, that's your point. That's one part. Now we're in a new part.
Isn't there another question again later on?
Later on, after...
Is the gun yours?
After he asks, why are you arresting my uncle, and then they answer for CCW, then he says, how about if I confess so that he can go free? And the officer answers, I just want the truth. I don't want you to admit to something you didn't do. Is it yours? So
and then
now
said,
that's...
And
now
then
I would,
said what?
I'm sorry?
And then he said what? Something like, yes, it's mine.
Then he
basically
repeated himself. He said, yeah, it's mine if you let my uncle go.
So that's the second question when he says, is this yours, right?
Right.
Okay.
But
and then Smith follows that up because he wants to make sure that this is a sound arrest. And so he follows that up with the question to make sure that the guy isn't just covering for his uncle. Then describe it for me. Can you describe the gun for me? Right?
Right.
And then the answer is a black 22 caliber, I think. Okay. So it seems to me we've got three. We've got the first time there's a question is, whose gun is this, when he just finds it. Then later when they're going back and forth, again he says, is this gun yours? That's quote. And then he asks, and then to make sure it's really his, he asks him to describe it. Is that correct?
Right, when he insists on making a conditional confession. And they said, all right.
I think the prosecuting attorney asked him, if I recall correctly, essentially, why did you ask him to describe it? And the officer, I don't have the exact words in front of me right now, so I paraphrase, Smith said, well, I asked him to describe it because I wanted to make sure it was his and I wanted to satisfy myself that it was really his. Am I close to it, or you want me to find
out? That was the point, is to make sure that this was a sincere confession and not a case where he's lying so that the man who was really guilty of the crime goes free. So, yes, and that, I assume, well, and I think that is correct, that was the point of that follow-up. All right, describe it for me. Yeah.
See, I see the case as, I think it's arguable, it's three stages. First stage, whose gun is it? That's a question. Not permitted. The answer isn't harmful, so we don't have a fight over the answer. Second stage, the defendant begins the conversation. Why are you arresting? And then you say, well, that's volunteered. The defendant asks a question, and the law enforcement officers have a right and maybe even a duty to honestly answer it, right? And there are cases that say that. So then the officer answers as to why he's arresting Mr. Henry. Then, for me, we got a third stage, and Martin interferes with all of this and indicates that maybe he's going to say something. And you have a third stage, if you were going to break this up into stages, where the cops go back to questioning Martin. And they say, is the gun yours? Question mark. And he says, yeah, with this kind of conditional commentary. And then they say, can you describe it? Question mark. Now, those are questions. He's he's in custody, right? And no Miranda. So why aren't those bad questions under Miranda? You say because they're trying to make sure it's not false. On the other hand, you say trying to make sure it's not false is not a defense to a violation of Miranda.
And I think, again, I think it's because of the nature of the conversation that he initiated, that he's asking questions that they have the right to answer, and he's making an offer to confess. And they have the right to clarify that in an appropriate manner. Now, and again, you know, you say there are three stages, and you start at the first question. Well, I would start at the point when he saw the road rage. Officer Fiddler saw the road rage incident, and Martin gave volunteered statements at that point. But even if we go back to your three stages, if we start with that first question, Miranda doesn't say everything that happens thereafter is inadmissible. Miranda says the answer to that question, whether inculpatory or exculpatory, is inadmissible. And I think we do have to keep that in mind. And then we look at what happened thereafter, and nothing improper happened thereafter as far as what prompted Mr. Martin to ask questions and to make an offer to confess. And then the police could ask clarifying questions. You know, is this a legitimate offer? Are you being honest with us?
It's not what they ask.
Well, they ask him to describe it. And you know, I think that, especially in light of the recent, the Moreno decision, I think that that's a proper clarification question in direct response to Martin's offer to confess if you let him go. I'll say the gun is mine. And so I think that that's, you know, again, Miranda does not disallow statements that a person voluntarily gives to police. It does not prohibit police from engaging, you know, if a defendant initiates conversation with police, asks questions, makes offers, complains about something, they have the right to respond. They, you know, Miranda and Innes apply to that sort of the classic custodial interrogation initiated by police or the psychological ploys that are its functional equivalent. And the fact, from beginning to the end of this encounter, Martin was not compelled because he was giving statements and asking questions from beginning to end, and he was reacting to what was going on around him, but what was going on around him was entirely proper. And the mere fact of custody doesn't require Miranda. That's clear from Rhode Island v. Innes. And only police-initiated interrogation requires Miranda. And, yes, there was one question that the trial court properly concluded should not have been asked, but that question elicited an exculpatory response from both men. It's a question that could have been asked of Henry, but perhaps not of Martin, but elicited an exculpatory response that cannot be used at trial, but does not necessarily taint everything that happened thereafter when Henry was lawfully taken into custody, and that prompted Martin to start this new exchange with the police on his own to blurt out the question, why are you arresting him, and then to make a conditional offer to confess. And that sort of give and take with the defendant allows the police to appropriately respond with answers to questions and perhaps a question of their own to clarify what the defendant is offering to do. I see my red light is on. And
if a Miranda warning was not given while the person's in custody, the defendant says many things used against him, is there still a defense that can the state still show that it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
I'm saying as long as there's no interrogation.
Well, let's say there's interrogation without Miranda. Can the confession still be saved by the state?
Well, Miranda says that voluntary statements are permissible, but I think my understanding of Miranda is that if the person is in custody and police are initiating interrogation, then at that point the warning must be given or the statement's inadmissible. Then you get into situations where the suspect qualifies, well, I'll give you a written statement but not an oral one, or he gives one statement but then later on you have the Oregon v. Elstead situation where new warnings are given and he gives an inculpatory statement, that sort of thing, where you get into areas of voluntariness and the degree that he invoked counsel. But I guess the long answer, or the short answer, is I think if direct questioning about even if the answer is voluntary, if you didn't give the warnings when you should have, then that statement is inadmissible.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Lichtstein, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. When I listen to the state's argument, it sounds to me like they want to eliminate the distinction between questioning and other kinds of police conversation or interaction with suspects. And I think that's really a bad idea, because what we have right now is a clear line. You have certain things that are clearly allowed, the hypothetical that Justice Prosser offered me earlier, confronting with evidence, answering a suspect's questions, making statements to the suspect, that's allowed. But when you cross the line to questions, then you have a different analysis. And you don't want to wash away that distinction. And why don't you want to wash it away? First of all, because you want a clear rule. And I can't figure out what clear rule could arise from a holding that was consistent with the state's argument here, where there's indisputably direct questioning. It's just impossible to know if Miranda's not allowed, not required here, then under what circumstances is it going to be allowed? We have a rule that makes sense now, a distinction between certain conduct and direct questions. You want to keep that distinction in place because it's simple and makes sense. The state called that a minor step, but I don't think it is a minor step. That's the basis of Miranda. It's about questioning. And what you had here was questioning. Other kinds of police conduct do not require Miranda, but when you get to questioning, that's where Miranda becomes relevant. Now, the issue came up during Mr. O'Brien's argument, well, why start the interaction? Why start the Miranda analysis at the issue of when the police find the gun and come and say to the two men, whose gun is it? And the question, I think, was asked, well, where should we begin it? And I've taken the position you should start it there. Why do I say that? Well, for a simple reason. That's where the questioning about the gun, the crime at issue, that's where it began. And if you look at the cases that are cited in Marino, and I appreciate Mr. O'Brien providing Marino, if you look at those cases, that's fully consistent. You start that analysis by looking at the point where the discussion, questioning about the crime at issue begins. And that's where it begins here. It doesn't make sense to back it up and start with every kind of irrelevant questioning that happened before. You start with the questioning about the crime, and that's where it began here. So that's the logical point to begin this. Mr. O'Brien said that our suggestion to the court is that essentially any questioning, if police say any kind of question to someone without Miranda, that automatically taints everything, and that is not our position. The position I'm taking is that when there is questioning about the crime at issue, that does require Miranda. Police want to ask the guy his name, if they want to ask him, you know, where should we take your car, irrelevant things that don't go to the criminal conduct, I don't think that does require Miranda. And that's clear from the case law that there's certain kinds of preliminary questioning that don't go to the criminal conduct that don't require Miranda. So we're not taking a broad position that any un-Mirandized questioning automatically washes away everything else. But when there is questioning about the criminal conduct without Miranda, then that is very much relevant to the question of where that interaction begins.
What are you asking that be suppressed?
The two statements that you mentioned in your question to Mr. O'Brien.
Then, and those two statements are?
Those are that his response that the gun's mine if you let my uncle go, and what he said in describing the gun. And I think you asked Mr. O'Brien, okay, well, are you saying that the answer needs to be suppressed to his response to the earlier question to both of them, whose gun is it? And my answer to that is I think, as the trial court held, Miranda was required there, but there's nothing to suppress. In my mind, because it isn't an incriminating statement. But I think that question is very relevant to the issue of whether Martin prompted the questions. He didn't prompt them.
Martin didn't take the stand here, so it couldn't be used to challenge his veracity.
That's right, Your Honor.
Harmless error.
Well, Your Honor, I think you don't need to go much further with harmless error than to look at the state's closing argument and the fact that the jury specifically asked about this exchange. Could I finish my answer briefly, Your Honor? My light is on.
You may complete your answer, please.
Thank you. The burden's on the state. They have to establish, and this is from Dice, D-Y-E-S-S, the verdict must be set aside unless this court is sure that the error did not influence the jury. You look at the state's closing argument, you look at the jury's question, there's no way you can be sure that this evidence did not influence the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lichtenstein. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel, Mr. Lichtenstein and Mr. O'Brien, for excellent arguments on yet another Miranda case and what constitutes a violation and what constitutes the need for suppression. We now conclude the hearing in 10AP505CR, State versus Randy L. Martin. The court will convene in closed session at 1:30 unless anyone on the court wants to reconvene at 2. We'll reconvene at 1:30 in closed session. The students, if they can, should remain, and I shall be out to speak with them. We are in recess until next week on oral argument.